It seems to me that a lot of people are afraid to be happy, myself included. I think we know in our subconscious that happiness actually has very little to do with accomplishments, so we feel that, or I feel, that if I allow myself to be happy, I'll lose my creative edge, and maybe even my desire to achieve things altogether. And I've sometimes felt resistant to doing things that I knew were good for me, for my physical and mental health, because I thought, well, if I reach this place of utter contentment, I won't be driven to pursue my career in comedy or music anymore. I'll just be fine existing. Which, first of all, isn't true, I don't think. Like, over the last year and change, I've stopped drinking, and I've started taking much better care of myself in a lot of ways, and I'm in a healthy relationship, and I definitely haven't lost my drive to create. I've arguably been even more productive since then. So it's weird to analyze this time too much because of the pandemic and how it's not our regular reality, but still. And this reminds me of something I talked about in last week's episode regarding acceptance, and the idea being that once we actually accept how we are, then we can actually change. And there might be fear of accepting how we are because then maybe we wouldn't feel the desire to change if we just accepted it, but it's actually the acceptance that creates the space for change to happen. Okay, and secondly, going back to the fear of happiness, like, we should be so lucky to reach such a level of contentment that we no longer feel this almost manic drive to churn out material. We're so afraid that we'll be too content, that we'll become too happy where we are in the present moment, that we'll stop trying to achieve. What a ridiculous thing to think. Like, if I'm so happy that I quit doing stand-up comedy, then I must be really, really happy because I love comedy. And that probably feels better than any momentary high I'd get from accomplishing things in my career. And I think goals are always good and they give us direction, mainly for our daily lives. It's good to look at a list of goals and say, what can I do today to accomplish these goals? But if we understand that it's the act of pursuing these goals every day that will bring us satisfaction and not the day that we finally achieve the goal, we might have better days more often, since we won't be living for some day in the future where we may accomplish this thing, we'll be living for today. And I actually find sitting down and writing a fulfilling experience in itself, sitting down and just writing. And, you know, I do have a goal of, like, eventually selling a script. And that goal helps direct my writing because I want to make it good and I know I need to write every day to make it good. So the goal helps me do something that I find fulfilling every day. It gives me structure. And if I do sell something, I'm sure it will feel good and validating, but I know because I've accomplished goals in the past, I know that the good feeling is fleeting. And I'm going to read you a quote now from a book that my uncle and today's guest, Mark Kapner, is working on. And he's someone who has accomplished many exciting things, and perhaps most notable, he played actually at the 1969 Woodstock Festival as the keyboard player for the band Country Joe and the Fish. And he's had just a really interesting life. And I think this passage from his book relates to what I've just been talking about with regards to happiness. So the passage is, "I feel fortunate to have had some wild and crazy experiences during a truly extraordinary time in America, the 1960s and 70s. I encountered some famous people, played with some very talented musicians, met some wise teachers, and I got to travel the world. Maybe all of this was a combination of luck, timing, serendipity, and my constant search for more and bigger adventures. But that sense of always striving, which is so conditioned into most of us, also managed to make me miss out on a lot of good times. I was often too busy planning for the next experience to fully enjoy the one that I was in." Does that sound familiar? So many of us live this way. We're so invested in the future that we're rarely fully present. Eventually, yoga and meditation managed to quiet my restless mind a lot, but I still thought there was something out there that I needed to acquire or control in order to be truly happy. All of this made me wonder what being happy really means, and when would I find out? So that's a passage from Mark Kapner's book entitled, I Didn't Get Laid at Woodstock, How to Be Happy with Whatever You End Up Getting While You're Getting It. In the episode, we will discuss this idea of happiness more and also talk about other cool things he's done. The swing dance camp he ran for 15 years for adults that I used to hang out as a kid at, and his 7 years of living at a yoga center, and if, in fact, he really didn't get laid at Woodstock. And he's my uncle, so I don't want to think about it too much. But anyway, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Mark Kapner. I understand you just woke up recently because it's 2 p.m. now, and your wake-up time is 11:30 a.m.
Well, it's usually 11:30 a.m., which is not the results of rock and roll. It's the results of advancing age and a prostate as large as a big lemon. I don't know if you want to get into the intimate details. You know,
right, right.
Otherwise, I'd be up probably at 10:30, you know, at 9:30 in the morning.
Right, right.
I wake up so much at night.
So do I.
A couple of hours. So that makes it hard for me to get enough rest.
Did you ever have a period where you were an early riser? Have you always been kind of a later riser?
Well, like when I lived at Kripalu, oh my God, after my 10 years of rock and roll, I moved to a yoga center called Kripalu Center, and I would get up at 10 of 4 so I could walk down and do an hour of my own exercises, you know, crunches and push-ups and stuff, before we had group yoga, and then we'd have group meditation. Then you'd eat breakfast and you'd be at work at 8.
And did that lead to sort of like a higher state of existence, would you say?
Were
you...
No, I'm tired all the time.
Yeah, really, it's just...
I had a delusion back then. I thought if only I wasn't so tired, then I would be wide awake all the time and really nice to people and effective and sharp. And I felt that because they told me I had to move from the main building to a 10-minute walk away. And I thought, 10 minutes this way, 10 minutes that way, that's going to come out of my sleep. And I was pretty grumpy. But one night I got 9 hours of sleep, and I came into work the next day in the kitchen, and I realized I was just the same old Mark, just much more wide awake and energetic, the same neurotic Mark. It didn't fix anything.
All of your flaws just had more steam.
Magnified.
Well, I have that feeling because I'm a chronic fatigue person. I'm always tired and I don't sleep well at night. I wake up a bunch of times in the middle of the night. I'm really tired right now. And I always think that if I just got enough sleep, everything would be different. And maybe that's not the case. Maybe I would just be more anxious than I already am.
I found that to be true because I was fascinated, you know, with the idea of more energy ever since college, where I was writing a paper and a woman said, well, here, take this. And she gave me a pill. And I sat there in the library, you know, writing furiously for 2.5 hours. And then I sort of read over it and it was garbage.
What was the pill?
An amphetamine.
Oh, okay.
With speed, yeah.
Right.
Which let me concentrate fiercely, but didn't improve the coherence of what I said at all.
Right. And how do you feel about drug use and sort of musical output? I know you performed at the original Woodstock in 69 with Country Joe and the Fish. And were you high during that? I mean, everyone was high probably, right?
Well, we didn't take any drugs. I didn't take any drugs that afternoon. We were high from, you know, just being there and looking out at the crowd, 500,000 people. And that day, the day we performed on Sunday, they flew us in on one of those big banana double rotor helicopters, you know, that they borrowed from the National Guard. So we were up high. And then
right. You were literally high.
We were very high. And then we got on stage and we were tuning up, and it was very exciting. And I looked out behind the crowd, and there was a wall of thunderstorms advancing quickly towards the crowd. No, we didn't get to play at the appointed hour because the thunderstorms came and drenched the crowd, and they hustled us off the stage into a truck and covered the equipment with plastic tarps. And there was a whole scene in the movie. At that point, we're in the truck, and someone in the truck had a camera, and he was filming two people having sex across, you know, in the rain. It was all, I think that was in the movie.
Right, right. Lots of people were having sex at Woodstock. But apparently, according to your book title, you were not one of them. You have a book that is called "I Didn't Get Laid at Woodstock: How to Be Happy with Whatever You're Getting While You're Getting It."
With whatever you end up getting.
With whatever you end up getting while you're getting it. So this was that actually true? You did not get laid at Woodstock.
I did not. I did not. And I found out from my local Mill Valley, California shoemaker, Tony, that Roger Daltrey didn't get laid either of the Who.
Okay.
Tony had gone to some event in San Francisco. He's a very popular guy, very personable shoemaker. Right. Met Roger Daltrey, who told him he didn't get laid at Woodstock. So
maybe it's a sign of greatness.
I hope so.
I think so. But your book, it's very, the idea behind it, I love it because, you know, you're someone who had such an interesting journey, you know, and you still are having an interesting journey, but you've done all these things that a lot of people haven't done, and you're still trying to find what it means to be happy, even after all of that, and this feeling of searching constantly, and this, you talk about this sort of itch you have all the time. When all these great things were happening to you, you were still feeling kind of this lack of something.
Well, it was a general restlessness. You know, there'd be a slight euphoria or a big euphoria for a while, a few minutes, an hour. And then, you know, the next thing, oh my God, now I want something else. And that kept going for many, many years until I had a series of sort of, I don't know if you call them revelations or epiphanies. A girlfriend broke up with me. And she said, I just can't deal with this. You never listen to me. And she would say that, okay, you know, every few weeks. And I would say, oh, yeah, you're right. I'm going to be a better listener for sure. But that was just like a puppy sitting up. Yes, give me another treat and I'll be good.
Right.
And it was totally manipulative. And it finally, she just said, no, this is it. And when she said that, it's like my life passed before me, just like that cliche. And I realized I'd never listened to anybody in my life, certainly not to women.
Right.
And that started with my mother. And I just didn't want to listen to all the stuff she's saying, which is basically don't do this, don't do that, or criticizing. So I learned not to listen. And then the next day, I realized, okay, so I've been pushing people away all my life and not listening to them at the same time that I've been an entertainer trying to get them to, you know, come to me and love me. And I realized what a crazy thing that was, how much energy it took to try to attract people and at the same time push them away.
That seems to be a common thread amongst a lot of performers, this lack of connection in their personal life, lack of, you know, not being able to listen, sensing something is missing, but then just wanting everyone to love them. And the only way they know how to do that is to get on stage. And I can certainly relate to that in a certain way. Like I sort of feel like as long as I can perform and connect with people on a stage, I'll be okay. That's my sort of infinite bliss. But really, it's like, well, how's my daily life and how are my daily relationships going? Oh, they're in the toilet. So, you know, what's the point? And you're never going to be satisfied by an onstage connection because that's just a temporary high.
Well, that's where the second, finally, epiphany came in. You know, when I lived at the yoga center, we were sort of steeped in Indian practices and Indian Eastern thought. At the same time I was living at the yoga center, I joined a Zen temple. So on my vacations from the yoga center, I would go and sit silent retreats at the Zen center. when I told that to mom, to my mother, and grandmother, she said, "That's crazy. Why would you sit in a room with people and not talk to them?"
Well, that's probably what you want. You wished you could do with your mom is sit in a room with her and not have to talk to her, not have to listen.
To do that, she would call up sometimes. It's sad to say, she would call up and I would just put the phone down, you know, go make a sandwich, come back, and she'd still be talking.
Right. So you were at the yoga center for 7 years and doing the Zen temple. And then, so what made you leave?
Well, the thing that made me leave the yoga center is it imploded because our guru got nailed for sexual improprieties with the sisters from 20 years before that were also ongoing. And it caught up to him. So they fired him. And the place changed from being a guru-centric, you know, bow down, oh, Guru Dev, thank you for giving me my life, to he's the devil, he's the perpetrator. We're going to keep teaching things like meditation and yoga, but without any guru stuff. So that's what happened to the center. But almost everybody, most people just left. And right. I came back to California. And it was wonderful to come back to California and not be in the sex, dope, and rock and roll world, which is what I had sought out and been successful in finding.
Right.
You know, back in the 60s.
And so back in the 60s, when you joined Country Joe and the Fish, what was the catalyst for that? How did that take hold?
Strange serendipity. I think everything in my life, serendipity, I think, is defined as when good things happen, things that you like happen, almost, and they seem accidentally that they're happening.
Right.
So there was a chain of chasing after women. I had gone out with this woman, and she was a strange folk singer who had a job singing outdoors at the Cannery, which was a shop complex in San Francisco. Just going, I went to see her sing, and I thought I'd be going off with her that night and visiting her folks, and there was another guy there. And I realized, oh my God. And my friend Phil Marsh was with me, and he said, well, there's a party at Barry's house. Let's just go. And Barry was the he was the guitar player for Country Joe and the Fish.
He was the fish.
He was the fish. And so we went to Barry's house, and it was a fun party, and I played a silly song on the ukulele, and I found out that their piano player had either been fired or left, quit, and that they were looking for a keyboard player. So I called up the next day and auditioned, and 2 weeks later I was on Johnny Carson and touring Europe. Serendipity. You know, if that woman hadn't, you know, given me the boot, if she hadn't, you know, gone off with another guy, I never would have gone to Barry's house.
Right, you might have had a wonderful night, but you wouldn't have gotten to play the Tonight Show in Woodstock. And did you feel sort of nervous calling up, asking for the audition? Were you like, this is a crazy thing I'm going to just jump into? Or did it sort of seem like, no, of course I should do this?
It just seemed like, of course, because I'd come out here saying I'm a musician. I came out with my banjo and my guitar. And I'd spent my whole life playing music and having people like it. You know, I had some indications, like in high school, I'd go to a party and I'd sit down and I'd play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis and sing, and everybody would jump up and sing and dance. And I'd break strings on the piano from pounding it so hard. And, you know, people would come up and say, oh, I wish I could. The basketball star would come up. I wish I could play like that. I'm muttering under my, I wish I could get all the girls like you do.
Right. It's always, you know, everything always seems like it'd be more appealing than the thing that you do.
Yeah. But I remember going to a party at our cousin Susan's house and playing piano again when I was about 17. And, you know, people saying, wow, you should be in a band. And it was like Donald Duck's Uncle Scrooge. Whenever he saw something that he thought could make him money, his eyeballs would pop and there'd be dollar signs. Or there was a movie called Swingers. And they'd say, oh, that's money. And that was sort of that hit that I have. Oh, maybe people would pay me money to play. So I sort of felt confident calling up Barry Melton and saying, hey, I'd like to audition. And when I went and auditioned, the guy before me was this bald jazz guy who was like all up and down a keyboard with all these runs and all these crazy chords. And I just sat down, and I was always just a dumb rock and roller. I grew up in the 50s and just loved simple rock and roll and playing stuff that fit. So I got the gig.
And what was the audition like? Was the band all behind like a big table and taking notes and and saying, we'll call you, thanks so much? Or did you get the job on the spot?
I don't remember. I remember playing some stuff with them. And I'd been a Country Joe and the Fish groupie a few years before. When I first went to California, I had met their drummer. And so I started driving him to gigs. He was a snaggletooth, greasy-haired hipster from New York. And we just hit it off. And actually, Grandma and Grandpa met him and were horrified that this was the kind of people I was hanging out with.
Right.
But so I knew the band, and I sort of knew their music. So I, you know, just had listened to their album before I went in for the audition. And it was all pretty straightforward.
Anyone can look at their life and kind of see the serendipity in it and realize all the things that they have. A lot of those came from one moment of chance.
And it's one moment that you might have thought at the moment, this sucks.
Right.
But in the end, you had no idea what the results were going to be. And this is what I realized and got me writing the book was when I was at Kripalu, they taught, okay, you're not in charge of the results. This comes from an Indian book called the Bhagavad Gita. You're not in charge of anything that happens. So give up the fruits of all your actions, blah, blah. And I thought that meant when you do something, if you don't like the results, you just go, ugh, that sucks. But I would be a good yogi and I would accept it.
Right.
That's what I thought that was. And I thought, well, that's weird, you know. And then years later, and then about 8 years ago, I met a teacher who said, no, that's not the way it is. It's as you're doing anything, remember you're not in charge of the results. So stop stressing.
I remember asking you about this because I remember we were in the car going up to Swing Out New Hampshire, the swing dance camp you ran for 15 years. And we can talk about that as well. But you told me, I'm practicing this idea of giving up the fruits of my actions. And I had trouble with that idea because I still felt like under all of that, there was this sort of desire to do that so that the results would be good. Because if you give up the desire for the fruits of your results, you're going to be more relaxed doing the thing and are actually more likely to succeed. And so it became this kind of weird paradox for me where I'd be sort of trying to like trick myself. And I asked you about that, and you had a good answer for it, but I don't remember because probably I wasn't a good listener either. But I think you just answered it for me.
Oh, good. Yeah, I just figured, I just thought about it a lot, and I realized, okay, am I ever in charge of the results of anything I do ultimately? And the answer is no. And then I asked myself, is there any result I could ever get that would bring permanent happiness? And again, the answer is no, because everything's always changing. So even though, you know, I might win the lottery tomorrow, something horrible might happen 20 minutes later. And if I'm attached to the results, what's my mood going to be as I do something? Total stress, total anxiety.
You're not going to enjoy what you're doing. And you write about that in the passage of your book that I read on your website. It's, you know, you did a lot of cool stuff, but you weren't actually able to enjoy a lot of the things you did because you were thinking about the next cool thing you were going to get to do.
Yeah, like when I was at Kripalu, if they had corn on the cob in late August, I'd take a couple of pieces. I'd be sitting there eating the corn, but I'd be looking at the cafeteria line to see if there was still corn. Because I wanted to go and get more corn before I even finished the corn.
I relate to that. The idea, you know, you want to make sure you can have seconds and thirds, and then you're just anxious while you're eating the thing that you enjoy so much. I keep getting these reminders through movies and like through you and through therapy that happiness doesn't come from anything. It doesn't come from an outer thing. It comes from inside. And I, you know, just to play devil's advocate though, like, don't you think sometimes there are these outer events or situations that can then be the catalyst to finding inner happiness.
But again, you weren't in charge of those things happening. And even if you did something to try and precipitate those things happening, you weren't in charge of whether or not you're going to be successful in getting those things to happen.
Right. But there is, I mean, there are things that I know I wouldn't get unless I tried, right? So there is like the trying part. Like you can't sit on the couch and say, whatever will come, or you guess you could.
You can, but that's not an answer either. That's also doing something.
Right.
Doing nothing is doing something.
So what are we supposed to do?
Nothing, thinking you're going to get a better result than if you do something. But in the end, there's always a situation and there's always something appropriate to do in the situation. And since we can't help but do stuff all day long, we might as well do stuff that's appropriate to the situation. Because if I look at my life and I do things that when I've done stuff that isn't appropriate to the situation, that's usually caused stress for me and the people around me.
When you're really trying to control something too much, usually good things don't come. It's often better to sort of wait and see what happens and, you know, manage it as you go. But something I was thinking about is when I would spend summers at Swing Out New Hampshire when I was 9 and 10, I would always sit in with the band at the dances at night and sing a couple of tunes. And, you know, it was fun, but I was still really shy at that point. I wasn't really that comfortable being the center of attention. But I felt like you kind of were pushing me to put myself out there. You were kind of jump-starting my career as a jazz singer. And I was very resistant to it. And now sometimes I think, well, what if I like hadn't been resistant? And what if I had really like let myself be on display, since I was 9, would I be like some famous singer now? Would that, and just that kind of thinking is not useful.
No. And my pushing you wasn't useful either, because all you did, you know, that would, you'd feel like, well, I push, you resist.
It was very rebellious.
A perfect dynamic there. And why was I pushing you? Because I wanted the pleasure, the selfish pleasure of, there's my niece.
Right. But, you know, I just knew that later on you would get, it was delayed because I became a performer, but
yeah,
it just took a little longer. And I wasn't going to be a jazz singer. I mean, that's not me. Is it? Did I miss out, Mark?
Well, you can be, after you become an opera singer, you can become a jazz singer.
Okay. Well, so you played on The Tonight Show with Country Joe. You also, before the Tonight Show, you were on Letterman for the Stupid Human Tricks.
That was after The Tonight Show.
Oh, that was after The Tonight Show.
Letterman was after I had left California and gone back to New York City.
Okay.
Because I wanted to get away from the world of sex, dope, and rock and roll.
Right.
So I'd gone back to New York to check out Grandpa's paper business. So I went from being a long-haired freak to wearing three-piece suits. And at Christmas time, I made a video. A friend of mine at work had an early video camera. So I made a video, Mark Kapner, The Christmas Message, 1984. And I had figured out how to play dental floss. I'd read about Vietnamese people twanging bamboo in their mouth like jews harps. And I wondered, if I twang my dental floss, can I just shape my mouth and make notes? And I couldn't. But I hooked it on my teeth and realized by tensioning it, by pulling and letting go, I could make notes, sort of like tuning a guitar string. And then the guy who had lent me the video camera's girlfriend worked for Letterman's show sometimes, and she sent the thing up to them, and they called me up and invited me to come on.
And so you were on Letterman playing Deck the Halls on the dental floss.
It was called Stupid Human Tricks.
Was that a high for you? What did that feel like, being on there playing the dental floss?
It felt normal.
I remember you telling me that backstage they told you don't try to be funny.
They did. They said don't try to be funny because this is his show and he'll destroy you.
I feel like you were funny though. Because I've seen...
I couldn't help myself.
I'll link to the video in the podcast description of your appearance on Letterman.
He said, is there anything you need? I said, can you give me a G? So his guy, what's his name? His band leader.
Oh, Paul.
Paul Schaefer.
Paul Schaefer.
G, and I tuned up my dental floss. So that was fun. But then after it was over, and he said, well, that was great, Mark. I forget if he asked me if I knew any other tunes, but I said, I know another tune. And he said, I'm afraid our lives are way too short for that. So that's what they meant about don't try and be too funny. But
right.
I thought it made him come off as being a little churlish and, you know, nasty.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mentioned the swing dance camp, and I'm sure people listening are wondering what that was all about. So can you talk about how you, after the yoga center, fell into the world of swing dancing and then starting a camp for that?
Yeah, they're all intertwined. You know, when I was in high school, junior high school, we started swing dancing to rock and roll in the 50s. And then that all died. And then when I moved back to California after the yoga center, I was facilitating a meditation group. And one of the women said, well, I can't come on Wednesdays if you change to Wednesday because I have my swing dance lesson. And my eyes lit up. So I went in with her and saw that there was a big swing dance revival happening in San Francisco. So I started doing it. And within about 8 months, I went to a couple of what they called swing dance camps. One was on Catalina Island. And another was at a college campus outside of Boston. And I saw it, and it was great fun. And you and I and our whole family had grown up going to Camp Walt Whitman in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I told the owner of Camp Walt Whitman of what I was doing. And I said, you should come swing dancing. Come on down to New York. I was visiting Mom. And he said, well, we could do a swing dance camp after the kids go home. So we did it. And the first summer we did it, I said, I know how to do it. I've been to two of them. And I've always been a party kind of guy. And Kripalu was like a big party.
Really?
Well, it was nonstop programs. And I played music for the programs. So for me, it was just like playing music for parties.
Just being in a community all the time, living amongst other people, it can just feel, I think that can lead to a certain happiness. Don't you think? Like, we are meant to be around other people. And I don't know, my tendency is to isolate and then I'll spend a week somewhere with a group of people for some music festival. And I'm like, oh, this is the way to live. But then I always go back to being alone.
It can go both ways though, because at a place like Kripalu, where you have lots of, you know, fun things and Indian devotional practices, so you're chanting and you're meditating and you're doing yoga together, yeah, it can feel very good to do those things. And we had sort of a veneer of, we all love each other, we're part of this big loving family, and we have a really wonderful loving guru who's taught me to love unconditionally, not like my stupid parents. That's what most people thought,
right?
You know, Gurudev's the ideal father. He's taught me how to love unconditionally, and I can tell he loves me unconditionally. Unfortunately, he loved some people with conditions. He had, you know, he manipulated them into having sex with them.
Right.
And underneath it all, you have a lot of people come to places like that because they're basically unhappy. Their lives aren't working on the outside, so they think, I'll go someplace and we'll just meditate and get really high. But you find you're living in a pressure cooker with 300 other people. And the exact same things that you wish you could get away from with your family and your work are amplified.
Well, your family drama will start maybe recreating itself in this new context after a while. You can't really escape it.
There's no escape. it's learning to live with the fact that that's human nature, because we're in dualities where it's hot and cold, and some like it hot, some like it cold. And whether you like it hot or cold one day can flip the next day. And we're just not in charge of all that. So can we just learn to live with the fact that we have bodies and we're constantly, and minds and emotions that are always just firing off? And that's where living at a yoga center can be great, because you can learn to quiet your mind or just let it quiet down by not chasing after all the thoughts and not chasing after, you know, trying to squelch the emotions, just watching them come and go. And then that can help you look and answer the question, is this stuff Mark says in his book true? Maybe I should try it. And then just try it, see if it works.
Right. And when you were the director of Swing Out New Hampshire then, did you feel like you were sort of getting to be the guru now? And was that a certain sort of satisfaction temporarily?
It was a funny thing, because I think, you know, I've never had kids. And here were my kids. You know, when I'd walk in to the main dance hall at night, and here's 300 people dancing and wonderful music, and everybody's just having the time of their life, I just looked around and said, okay, I got my clipboard, I got my microphone, I've done my job.
Well, you did it, what I think is a funny thing, where you really tried to dress like a typical summer camp director, even though this was a camp for adults. You know, it was basically just a Labor Day weekend getaway for adults, but you walked around with a whistle and a clipboard, and then I would come and I'd be Mini Mark, so I'd get a little whistle and a clipboard too. And I remember the first summer I was going to go, like, sort of hang out there, you said, so do you want to, like, take dance classes, or what do you want to do? And I said, I just want to go around and tell people what to do.
You want to ride around on the golf cart with me and tell people what to do. And we did it. It was so wonderful. You came up to me that summer. You came running and saying, Mark, there's people sitting on the boats on the docks that they've taken out of the lake. Let's go tell them to get off. So we got on the golf cart with our clipboards, and we went down there, and you just stood up and said, excuse me. It was great.
Well, I was a real tattle. Adults loved me, but you could see why other kids didn't like me, because I was just a fucking tattletale and, you know, loved rules and things. And it. So I loved staying, because I went to Camp Walt Whitman. I went to the kids' camp. But then I got to stay after to when you showed up with all the adults. And that's where I really thrived, amongst adults and hanging out with those people. With the kids, I just really had a hard time socially, because I was just kind of weird and, you know, liked rules and was kind of a bummer.
Well, it's hard. I feel you. I'm the same way.
But I think that tendency that, you know, not wanting to break rules, that's in a way the search for control, right?
That's the big brother of wanting things to come out of wanting results. I will try to control the results skillfully.
Well, either you cling to the system and the rules that are already there, or you become a rule breaker and you try to control your own life in that way. You say, fuck these rules.
Same.
They're not going to dictate what I do. But it all comes from the same place.
To a yoga ashram. And you think, I will be spiritual and I will transcend everything, and then I will be eternal. That's nonsense too.
And then the guru fucks the sisters.
Exactly.
And then where are you? Well, I was reminded also of something you used to do. I guess maybe this was when you were with Country Joe and the Fish, and there was like an opening act where you would do a Tiny Tim impersonation and then set your ukulele on fire.
Well, I heard this Tiny Tim song back around, must have been 1968, and I loved it, and I started playing it on the ukulele, and I think that when I went to Barry Melton's party that night, I played that song, and I just loved it, because it was so bizarre. So it was a wonderful song, and then somehow I started with Country Joe. I don't know if I suggested it, I don't know how that came to be, but I thought that the Who smashing their guitars and Jimi Hendrix lighting his guitar on fire, I thought that was just silly and nonsense, you know, slapstick kind of comedy, but slapstick violence.
Right.
So I decided I would make fun of that by singing the Tiny Tim song and then making love to my ukulele while the band played Foxy Lady in the background, and then smashing the ukulele to bits and throwing the pieces to the audience.
So Country Joe let you do this in the front as the band played.
Yeah, we did this every set. I mean, every night. We had a case of ukuleles we traveled with. And I found it just amazing to be... I think that's the introduction to the book, describing doing it on stage in Sweden, or in Denmark, and just thinking, damn, they're paying me to do this. This is so weird, so wonderful to just be having fun.
Would you say that, I mean, you seem like you're pretty enlightened at this point in your life. Is that just something you seem like, or do you think that's true inside?
I think I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life. And I think that I just sort of go back to remembering in all kinds of situations, just that sort of just saying to myself, I give up my desire for any results from doing this. Like, I give up my desire for any specific results from sitting here talking with Isabel. You know, rather than thinking, oh my God, I hope this is a good podcast. I hope I don't ruin it for her. I hope I don't sound like an idiot. I hope I don't sound like a stupid old guy. I hope I don't, I'm okay, boomer. You know,
you're one of the most fun people I know, Mark. And this, I know this from an unpleasant experience I had because I used to date somebody who will remain nameless, but I'm sure you'll remember when I tell you the story. But we were taking a trip to... We went camping in Big Sur, and around on either side of the trip, we spent time in San Francisco, and we met up with you, and we had dinner, and then we went for coffee, and you were so entertaining and so fun. And I know that my at the time boyfriend just like had so much more fun with you than he ever was having with me. And I had a real complex about it because I already didn't think he liked me that much. I was always like, why are you dating me? I don't really think you like me. And then I just saw him light up having dinner with you, and it confirmed it. And he always referenced you later on. He'd be like, oh, I mean, Uncle Mark, like, he's more fun than a lot of my friends. And I knew when he said a lot of my friends, he meant me. So, well,
I'm glad that I played a serendipitous part in your arriving at where you are today.
Yes.
Totally enlightened, happy, you know, living with the COVID without a care in the world.
That's true. If it hadn't been for that really fun dinner with you, maybe...
Actually, I think it was more, we were sitting in this bar at the coffee place. It was like it was called, I don't remember what it's called, but it was one of the hippest coffee places in San Francisco. And a woman walked in wearing like a little plaid skirt. It's just weird stuff, and they were playing really weird music. And as we walked out, I started rapping, and it was a rap about what we had just seen inside the place. And I think that's what your guy liked at that point. Yeah,
I think you also won him over with a song you had written about a hamburger. I mean, you were pulling out all the stops, Mark.
Yeah, hamburger song.
But then I had another boyfriend who met you, and I said to you, "Sing him the hamburger song. He'll love it." And then that boyfriend wasn't having any of it.
Okay.
So I mean, that didn't work out either. I was just, I realized because of that he was just like not a fun guy at all.
He was searching for that sweet spot in the middle.
Right.
Somebody who could appreciate you totally and appreciate me just as part of your garland of wonders.
Right. Yes. As an extension of me.
Exactly.
Not. Well, you'll have to meet Will and we'll see.
I look forward to it. I hope he didn't take affront at my saying that I hated the Grateful Dead.
Oh, not at all. So you played at Woodstock with the Grateful Dead.
Well, we were both on the bill. I don't remember seeing anybody from the Grateful Dead at Woodstock. The only other time I heard the Grateful Dead, I think, was I went to the Fillmore West, and there was a double bill with Miles Davis and the Grateful Dead. And I was sitting up in the balcony, and someone passed me a joint, And I took a hit not knowing that it wasn't just a joint. It was laced with PCP.
Oh, no.
Which is the horrible animal tranquilizer that made you feel like Rubber Man and vaguely nauseated and bleary-eyed. Anyway, so listening to Miles Davis and then The Grateful Dead, I fell asleep during The Grateful Dead again.
Do you think that was because of the PCP, though?
No, I think it just facilitated my falling asleep, but the cause was The Grateful Dead.
Well, do you have any final words of wisdom, Mark? This has been such a pleasure talking to you.
The only words of wisdom I could think of would be take it easy, wash your hands frequently.
Uh-huh.
Don't obsess about the mail or packages from the store.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be how it's spreading.
It's not the main thing, yeah.
It's damn people.
It's those people again, yeah. But they can't help themselves. They're breathing COVID. What can you do?
Right.
But God, we stay away from them, yeah, as much as
possible. Right, right.
But yeah, and in the midst of a plague, and in the midst of civic unrest, take it easy.
Well, I find it inspiring that at 77, in the midst of civil unrest and a plague, you're the happiest you've ever been.
I think it's pretty wonderful.
Yeah. Well, Mark, as always, an honor.
Isabel, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. For more, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, both at IsabelHagen_. And sign up for my mailing list at isabelhagen.com. And as always, please rate and review the podcast. Thank you so much, and take care.